Greetings once again from the podcast basement. I feel like the Dick Cheney of podcasts. I'm in an undisclosed location. This is Richie Phillips, and this is Take It to the Top. And the idea here, very simple. The idea here, it's very simple. You pick a category, or I pick a category, and try to get the best person to represent that category. And this week, we are talking about top comics. And I think I got one. John DeCrosta is listed online as, well, he's actually listed online as an actor first, which I got to ask him about that because I didn't know that part. I know him as a comedian that I used to work with in Albany, New York here at a club called The Comedy Works. The original one, long gone. But the owner's son has kept the tradition going. He's got a club of the same name in Saratoga, New York. You folks around here, I'm sure, have visited that place. It's such a great place. I used to be one of the MCs at the original Comedy Works. I won't tell you what year. And then I would do my stand-up keyboard act with parody songs, which I still do for conferences, retirement parties, anniversaries, whatever. Just go to www.hirerichie.com for information. See how I slipped that in there. But I digress. I want to get right into this. Let's hear a little bit of John DeCrosta talking about going to a grocery store down south and the, shall we say, culture shock that he experienced.
I'm in a supermarket. I'll never forget the Piggly Wiggly. You know, I'm not lying. And I couldn't find a damn thing. I go up to the counter. I said, excuse me, ma'am. Could you show me where the bagels are, please? Lady goes, bagels! What the hell's a bagel? But I don't know, but I like watching you talk. I said a bagel is like a round, hard donut. She said, oh, yeah. And what you do with it? I said, well, you could play a little ring toss on that, too.
And that's a cut from his album, Character Disorder, which you can order online. I'm sure he'll tell you where. Let's get right into it. Ladies and gentlemen, he's right in Los Angeles, California, as we speak. John DeCrosta. Well, I am here with comedian, thespian, right?
Ooh. Yeah.
Right? Actor.
I think you're the first to call me that.
Yeah. Well, thespians have rights now, which is great.
And, yeah. And I hear they can marry.
And he has a great album, Multiple Character Disorder, and I see that you still have that. After all the years of me seeing you, ladies and gentlemen, John DeCrosta, I'm so excited to have you on. Really,
thank you so much. I appreciate it. It's good to be here.
I just played the bit before you got on here, but of you going to the grocery store down south and the culture shock that you experienced. That's a great bit, the bagel. Oh my god!
You know, everything I do in my show, everything. Whether an audience member has something negative or positive, and thank God I get one maybe negative thing every 3 to 5 years.
Right.
99.999% of it's all positive. But my defense is always it's based on an actual episode in my life that has occurred. I'm not making something up that may be politically incorrect or offensive to you. I'm simply recreating a scene from my life that actually happened, whether it be an impression of an Asian guy or an impression of whatever the situation is. It's based on a real happening or a real person.
I'm going to ask you about that exact thing, about you doing dialects, and if you've gotten any pushback from that. That's one of my questions. But I want to start from the beginning. Like, we go back, literally, I did the math, and I'm not good at math, but it's close to 35 years.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You played in a place called The Comedy Works. And I want to go back before that. Are you from the Albany area? I don't even remember.
Well, depending on how far you want to go back and how long you want to dwell on it, I was born and raised for a short period of time in Italy. My
really?
Dad was in the service. He's from there.
Huh.
He came to the country when he was 17, learned English, became a citizen, and went into the Air Force, and they shipped him back to Italy. So I was born there. I came here to the States in fourth grade, and I lived in Syracuse from fourth to ninth. In the ninth grade, in 1976, I moved to the Schenectady area, and I was there from 76 to 2000.
Gotcha. So the place that you played, the place that I originally met you, was a place called the comedy works. Well, I have to call it the original comedy works because there's there's another one now. The son of the owner of the original comedy works runs that comedy works. Correct.
Correct.
And I just always remember I couldn't wait for you to come on because no matter who was on there, you were always the bright spot for me. I always just enjoyed you. I always thought you were hysterical. And I just always wondered whatever happened to you.
We used to, those were, that was definitely the groundwork for what is me today. Those were some really great, because if you remember in those days, there was about seven or eight of us acts that were on every single weekend.
Yes.
It was me, you, Steve Van Zandt.
Correct.
Peter Montecup.
Yes, Peter Montecup.
Joe Schroeder.
Yes.
The double D's.
The double D's.
And that wasn't a stripper. who else? I think that's probably mostly it.
Well, I was going to say, he had a band. Ventriloquists?
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. Oh, you have a very good memory. That's right.
Yeah.
That's the end of an era. I know you play comedy clubs all over the place. You don't see multiple, you don't see like a variety show in these comedy clubs now. That couldn't happen anymore.
No. Yeah, that was definitely a dinner variety show every Friday and Saturday. Yeah. That was something. I remember the most fun we had one night, Steve Van Zandt and Montecup and all of us. We had worked together so much. We each made a pact one morning or one evening that we were going to do each other's acts. Oh my God. I think that's one of the hardest nights I've ever laughed. It was so much fun.
And you actually did it.
Yeah, I did Peter Montecup. I think Steve did me. Everybody did each other. And it was so much fun because you're like, wait a minute. I don't do that. I don't sound like that. It was so much fun.
Well, how could somebody
really
do
really enjoyable?
How could somebody do Steve, though, if you can't do impressions? That's the tough thing, right?
Nah, Steve's got certain mannerisms that you can recreate. I forget. Oh, God, it was just such a great night.
Yeah.
We only did it one time, and it was epic. It was really a lot of fun.
Who do you think you modeled your comedy after? I consider you a little bit, and I don't mean this in a negative way, totally positive, a little bit of a throwback to like the comic stylings of like a Rip Taylor. You don't remember Rip Taylor, who's just like bizarre?
Sure.
Do you?
My earliest comedy influences were the variety shows of the 70s. But as far as stand-up goes, my first inspirations were the Smothers Brothers.
Right.
That was as far as me being a comedy fan. But my two first guys that I kind of patterned / modeled my persona after, which doesn't mean that I copied them, but that I kind of gravitated towards that style, was Steve Martin and Robin Williams.
Right. Yep. I could see that.
Yeah,
definitely.
Of the late 70s, early 80s, that's definitely the direction I went. Now, in those days, that was not frowned upon, but you weren't a purist if you used anything more than a microphone stand.
Mm-hmm.
But I started as a ventriloquist, so I gravitated towards having something with me on stage, whether it be a prop, a wig, a puppet, whatever. So I gravitate towards that style of the manic all over the place.
Right.
I don't know which direction I'm going kind of style of comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Especially my very first concert that I ever went to, everybody remembers their first concert. Mine was Steve Martin at the Saratoga Performing Arts Center in 1979. That was my first concert.
Interesting.
I remember there was a morning, an afternoon show and an evening show, and I bought tickets to both. And I just sat there in awe saying, oh my God, look what he's doing to this crowd. And he's doing it with jokes and silliness. And I said, this is what I'm doing for life. And here I sit, you know.
Well, you have to come back to Albany because in February he's coming back.
Yeah, he's actually live in Los Angeles for the last 18 years. And him and Marty Short are actually performing here in July. And tickets go on sale today. So I have my afternoon planned.
I watched it on TV. Might have been Netflix.
It was on Netflix. I can't wait.
Oh.
I can't wait to see it live.
Hysterical. Now that's a real throwback show, too, like vaudeville.
Sure.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Variety. You know, I still do ventriloquism on the ship, and because I just think there's such a huge room for variety still. I mean, whether it be music or ventriloquism or impressions or whatever the case is, there's room for everything. And if you're good at it, why not? And I always like to have that something extra for people.
Sure. Now, you stayed with it for 35 years. So you left Albany, right? Mm-hmm. And then how did you get to Los Angeles? I'm sure that wasn't just a direct connection to Los Angeles. You did something in between.
I moved here for animation voiceover animation voiceover in films and TV and video games, which I've had great success in.
Hmm.
And while I was here and still am a voiceover actor, which started there in the Albany area, I fell into the world of audience warm-up. I did a lot of TV shows like American Idol. My first job was Politically Incorrect with Bill Maher.
No kidding.
I did the Late Late Show with Craig Kilborn. I did American Idol, Dancing with the Stars, America's Got Talent.
Jeez.
America's Funniest Home Videos. And any show that has a live studio audience, they require a guy like myself that's dancing around in the stands, keeping everybody happy and busy. So I made a living at that for 10 years until the cruise ships fell in my lap. But so simultaneously for, you know, my first, 9 or 10 years, I made a living exclusively doing animation voiceover and audience warm up. And then this whole ship thing just took over. And I've been doing that for the last 8 years while, fitting in voiceover when I can.
Before we get to the ships, so what are some of the video games that you did?
My first one was called Jak and Daxter. I did a game called Dead to Rights. I did a game called Command and Conquer, Yuri's Revenge. I'm in several movies, a little thing called Transformers.
Really?
I'm in a Lego movie. I was on a show on Nickelodeon called Invader Zim. I've done okay. I mean, me, Michael Bay, and a sound guy was a pretty great day.
Jeez.
When I did the Transformers. I'm in Transformers 2 as about 8 or 9 of the Decepticon characters. One actually very main character in Transformers 2 called the Doctor. I resurrect Megatron that's left for dead at the bottom of the ocean from the first film, and it was my job to resurrect him in the second film, so I'm responsible for bringing Megatron back to life.
And I was listening to a couple of your interviews. Didn't you play a dead guy on TV?
I did on the X-Files. I was a dead guy. What does that say about my acting? I was the best one that didn't do anything in the audition.
And you had to audition as a dead guy.
Yes.
How do you do that?
And I was the best dead guy.
In what way? Because of your expression?
I could roll my eyes back. I do this bit in my family show. I could roll my eyes back so they turn completely white for 30 minutes with no makeup. That's what got me the gig.
I'm glad we have an audio podcast because I really don't want to see that.
Oh, it's pretty creepy.
Now, I want to see if this plays because this was another... I couldn't believe this when you mentioned on one of your interviews. Oh, no, it was on your album. You mentioned that you were the voice of something. Let me see if I can play this.
You might not recognize my face, but you might recognize my voice. I do a lot of... I moved to L.A. about 10 years ago for animation and that kind of... Actually, the first job I ever... I did this for 18 months. You guys are going to hate me for this. You ready? Ready? Who can shout this character out? Ready? Woo-hoo! Pillsbury Doughboy. That was me for 18 months.
That's
no,
true.
Don't applaud that. I'm the laziest.
Yeah. That's incredible.
Yeah.
So you get like residuals said, every time you hear a woohoo? Do you get a residual?
Yeah, like I say in my show these days, I go, doing the dead guy bought me. I roll my eyes back and I say to the kids that are usually in the front row, because I do this in my family show, I say, yeah, don't listen to your parents, kids. Your eyes don't freeze that way. In fact, that playing the dead guy bought me a very nice car and bought me a house. God bless America.
Which leads me to my next question. On the clean, dirty continuum, I never remember you as being a dirty comic, you've always basically stayed somewhere in the middle there? Or you say you do a family show, but you're also...
I have adult material and an adult language, but I've never beat anyone over the head with it. In fact, the thing I really pride myself in is I have, let's say, elderly people come up to me weekly saying, you know what I like about you? You don't use the F word. Little do they know, it's salt and peppered within my act probably 8 or 9 times, but they don't hear it because it's used strategically where right. It doesn't blow up in your face. Now, certainly not in the family shows, but in the adult shows, we're all adults and words are used. But I don't use it in a manner that is just offensive and you go, ooh, he didn't need that word, because you don't even know what's happening.
Which was my next question. Yeah, if you saw a totally disgusting comic, would that just completely turn you off, or do you still see the value in somebody who's a dirty comedian?
Well, it depends on how he's using it.
Right.
Is he using it as a crutch because he can't write words, or is he using it just simply for a punctuation, which is in the manner in which I use it. Mm-hmm. I just use it for effect. I don't use it as a substitute for words I can't think of. If it's used just as shock value, just to use it, it's silly. It's a crutch. It's a cop out.
Exactly.
But if you use it as a punctuation, like we do in our everyday natural speaking to a buddy at out at the park, then I think it's fine.
Mm-hmm. Correct. I want to get to the political correctness topic. I did, since I've seen you, I did 29 years of morning radio here in Albany, and we always had the FCC kind of hanging over your head. Of course, you're in, radio. You're going to have those kind of restrictions. It got to a point my last few years that it really, really restricted me. There was like a big filter, I guess is the best word. Everything that we talk about, I started to get nervous about. How do you combat that?
I've seen this coming for decades. Really? I remember back in the 80s in the upstate New York area when I was doing colleges, whether it be RPI or Russell Sage or Siena or whatever the case may be. I remember towards the end of me doing colleges, I remember anything that was slightly politically incorrect. Each year, I got more and more, ooh, come on, guys.
Seinfeld said that.
Just joke, yes. And when he came out with that quote, I chimed in on Facebook and all the social networks that I couldn't agree more. I stopped in the 80s because of it.
Wow, that long ago.
And absolutely. And now, as far as with my show goes now, yes, I absolutely do politically incorrect stuff, salt and pepper throughout my show. I continue to, because it's not done in malice. It's done because I've encountered these people in my travels and these predicaments and situations that I've been placed in. I'm recreating on stage, and those are the people involved in the story. And so I've yet to hear any negative pushback from anything I do. It's a matter of time. The thing I'm most concerned with is I do a little Steve Irwin bit, and I'm going to Australia in January. And I'm actually starting to panic because I don't know how I'm going to reword that bit, because it's such a powerful piece. But I'm going to have to restructure it to sound like an homage instead of a characterization, you know what I mean? It's so you do have to retool things, and I'm not opposed to retooling to make certain groups a little happier, but I'm not dropping anything in my show because, I was offended by this.
Well, that's...
You know what I mean?
You have to develop a thick skin for doing it as long as you've done it. Otherwise, you never would have been successful. Right. In case you're wondering what and who am I listening to, this is The Top, and I am talking with actor, comedian, voiceover artist, and most importantly, Pillsbury Doughboy, John DaCrosta. Can you imagine? That was his job for 8 months?
That was my work day. Do you understand what I'm saying? It's not like I'm going to f*** up the line. It's like, wait, what was it? What was it? It's not like I'm going to do it different ways. Like one way, he's drunk, you know? He's like...
All right, let's get back to the interview.
Yeah.
I was thinking about this. If somebody was not funny at all in the beginning, mm-hmm. but just so mm-hmm. stupid, stubborn, thick-skinned, went to New York City, did three shows a night, you know, just jumped from comedy club to comedy club to comedy club, 7 days a week, and did it for years, do you think that they still could cob together a funny act just by accidentally stumbling on good stuff?
There's so many parts to the answer for that question. And for lack of time to break that question down in so many reasons for the answers, that my basic answer to that is, I think, me personally, and I'm not saying, I'm sure some are better than others, but I think, quote unquote, comedy, stand-up comedy classes are BS. Mm-hmm. I think you either have it or you do not have it. You have a way of looking at the world and things that are happening, and a guy at the mall, and a thing that happened to me at the park, or whatever the situation. You have a way of looking at things and turning it into something funny, or you don't. I don't think it can be taught. I think it can be, if you already have it, it can be tweaked. And it can be made better, and you can sharpen the tool, but I think you have to have it initially. So somebody that went to the city and wasn't funny at all, through time, you might be able to get a 10-minute chunk together, maybe 15,
right.
But a 45 to an hour.
Yeah,
I just don't think. I think you got to have it already, and then you need to fine tune your instrument. That's my short answer.
I just think it's the gutsiest form of entertainment ever is being a stand-up comic with you and a microphone. Like, I've gotten up there and I've done my shtick, but I have a keyboard. So if somebody's not laughing, I can just play, and they might laugh at that. You know what I mean? That was always my fallback position. But to just stand there with a mic,
yep.
I think it just takes an amazing amount of guts.
Aside from, you know, just being a basic public speaker, I guess it's got to be one of the top three or four jobs where... Yeah, I mean, the job is to stand up there and deliver original material, and the result is laughter. If there's no laughter, you've failed at that position.
Right. To come back the next night.
Yeah, right. It's pretty damn gutsy. I mean, it's not like a regular 9-to-5 where you have a review every quarter or twice a year.
Right.
We get judged every evening. We get thumbs up or thumbs down at the end of every 30 to 45 minutes.
That's right.
Every night. And so, we're graded every night.
Versus, you must have found the acting part where you go into a studio and it's just a microphone and you in a room doing a video game voiceover. That's a totally different way of performing, isn't it? Do you find that without the audience, it was like weird in the beginning?
Well, the voiceover, yes. There's definitely a certain difference to receiving reaction to your performance. Yeah, it's definitely when you're in a soundproof booth and you don't hear any type of reaction or laughter unless they turn their microphone up on the other side of the glass.
Right.
You're not hearing what kind of job you're doing. The place where I can really compare that to, as far as, wow, this is very odd and very different for me, is I went through Groundlings, which is the improv school here in Los Angeles.
Sure.
That a million and one really great comedic actors have been through, you know, Will Ferrell and Sherry O'Terry and Tina Fey and Lisa Kudrow and Pee Wee Herman. And I mean, you could go on forever. But I took those classes, and there's four classes. There's, you know, beginner, intermediate, advanced, and then you get into the lab where you write sketches and stuff. And I went through the beginner thing just to see how, what it was all about. And I remember there were 16 students, and in that 16 students, you know, I'm going to be honest with you, 10 to 12 had zero comedic timing or they just, you know, they were right off the bus, where I had already been performing stand-up for 20-25 years.
Sure.
So to perform an exercise and get from A to D, and you have to hit on B and C, I saw D immediately because I've been performing comedy. Well, sometimes when I was forced to do this exercise with somebody that didn't possibly maybe know what they were doing, you know, they were taking forever to get to B.
Hmm.
And I would be, as a good student, sitting there with them on step B, and I'm trying to do it in a funny way, and I'm not getting laughs.
Right.
Talk about flop sweat.
Oh, right. And you could have been funny, but the situation made you not funny. Right.
Yes, exactly. I was being forced to not be funny.
Right.
That killed me. So I would go from A as fast as I could through B and C and get to D to get to the punchline, and then I would get a laugh from the class and I would get chastised.
That is very difficult.
Don't go for the laugh. No, you got to hit all the steps.
Right.
And I'm like, I see the light at the end of the tunnel immediately.
So there's literally.
But I had to go through that silence, and it was crushing.
Was it expensive to take a course? I would think they would charge an arm and a leg for that.
It was average. I don't remember it, you know, breaking the bank.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, look, it's a school, and they're in business to make money. So I feel, I just had a discussion with a friend of mine about this just the last week. I have a feeling that a majority of the students are not passed on to the next step because they want you to come back to the first step to generate income.
Uh-huh. Yep.
That's my feeling.
Sure.
I'm not saying that that's what happens, but the observation I made when I left there, I go, uh-huh, okay, I see how this works.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
So what would your advice be to somebody who didn't have any talent? No, who had a little bit of comedic talent but still, you know, wanted to try the stand-up comedy route? Where do you start? Obviously,
the stand-up is so universal now.
Mm-hmm.
Where back in, you know, we were groundbreakers as far as not being quote-unquote comedians, but as far as the comedy club generation, it was definitely the 70s and 80s. I mean, that's when it all began becoming what it is today. Today, there's an open mic at every Subway sandwich shop. You know what I mean? There's open mic night everywhere. And in your particular area, I think Tommy's got open mic nights. It might be like maybe Wednesday or Sunday or something like that. If you're funny with your friends, quote-unquote, go put together a 4 to 5, 6 minute set and try and perform it in front of not your friends.
Exactly.
And see how you do.
Right. I mean, you can do it on YouTube, but then again, you don't have an audience. But that's
you got to listen to the reaction. You got to see if something works. And the only way to do it is in a room full of live people.
That brings up another question. On TV these days, I mean, back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, if you were on The Tonight Show, that was your entree into the world, right? What do you think is the holy grail of exposure these days on TV? Who would you say would be the top place? Would it be a Colbert?
Unfortunately, the late night shows don't use a ton of comics like The Tonight Show used to. Leno slowly weeded out stand-ups, and you still see them. Jimmy puts on, you know, a fair amount. Colbert puts on a little less than that.
Less, yeah.
None of the West Coast. Conan does. Conan puts on, but it's really not the Holy Grail these days. Right now, the Holy Grail is a Netflix special.
No kidding. No kidding.
You know, yeah. Jeez. Yep, that's the Holy Grail now.
Boy, has that changed.
Yeah, where years ago, you know, it was definitely The Tonight Show. That was and Letterman. That was those were the two Holy Grails. And now, I mean, you and I have both seen what has been on The Tonight Show. And some of has been, you know, great. And some has been subpar or worse. In my opinion, I'm not saying that they weren't worthy, but it's just, you know, they're filling time, they're filling space. Yeah. I don't know. And of course, you know, tastes are changing. You know, the style of stand-up isn't what it once was. You know, a lot of the people that are up and coming now don't have the setup, the story, and the punchline anymore. Right. It's just not the style.
Has that influenced you in your act? I mean, your act?
Absolutely not.
No, it hasn't.
Zero.
I haven't seen you in 35 years, and you still, when I heard you, it's still, I could picture you. You know, it's still the same style you had.
Huh. Yeah.
Interesting.
No. I look, in my opinion, look, I don't care about your relationship with your parents when you were a kid.
Right.
If you have a funny story, I want to hear that first. Then I want to hear how you feel about your dad. That's not important to me. Mm-hmm. I just had breakfast with two of my best pals here in Los Angeles. We get together about two or three times a month. Two very, very, very successful comedians. One had a sitcom. One tours with Howie Mandel every single week. John Mendoza and John Campanaro. We have breakfast once a month, or twice a month. And, you know, I'm falling out of my stool in the diner because we're telling jokes and funny stories. That to me is what it needs. I don't want to sit through a 6-minute story and then hear a punchline.
But that's, you know, another question. Do you find that when your friends are comedians that it's a different conversation when you're not on stage and you're just sitting at a diner? Like, are you trying to one-upsman each other? Or?
Yeah, but not in a contest way.
No?
In a fun way. You know, I mean, we each had a story about a drunk guy this morning. You know what I mean? And we each told our drunk guy story.
Okay.
It wasn't a like, oh, if you think that's funny,
you're right.
Listen to this.
You don't feel pressure then. Okay.
No, it wasn't in that. But there's nothing. There is nothing sweeter than making another comedian whom you respect laugh.
Exactly.
There is no sweeter feeling.
Sure.
When they're wiping tears and their face is red, and they're oh my God, do you do that on stage? You should do that on stage.
Uh-huh.
When you hear that, oh my God, you've been validated.
Do you feel sometimes when people come up to you after a show that they're kind of subliminally trying out their material on you?
Always,
don't they? Yep.
Always.
And you try to be as polite as possible. We used to get that with radio, you know, like, or they'd say to you, oh, you're the guy from WGNA out here. Yeah, yeah. Come on, be funny for us. Do you get that?
Yeah.
Oh, I couldn't stand that.
Oh, absolutely. That's why on a plane, when you're trapped on a plane and you got 3 or 4 hour flight somewhere, and they go, so what do? I never say comedy.
Right.
Never. Because they're, A, going to be trying out their material that makes Uncle Tony laugh.
Exactly.
Or B, expecting you to be on stage.
Right. Say you're a funeral director or something like that, right?
Yeah, I'm a fire eater. Oh, I guess you can't show me how to do that.
Yeah, you don't want to do that. Yeah. So just to wrap this up, so now you are doing cruise ships for the most part. Is that how you mostly make your living now?
Yeah, these days that's about 75% of my work. I do. I work pretty exclusive with Carnival, and I've done about 423 cruises. That's 423 times 5 shows, so close to 2,300 shows I've done for them.
Amazing.
They keep me very busy. And that's only in the last 8 years. And then when I'm home, I'm auditioning for, you know, commercials. And this morning I have an audition for Red Bull. And I had an audition a couple days ago for DreamWorks. So I'm always auditioning for voiceover stuff as well, and on-camera commercials. And so, you know, I'm trying to juggle both. But like I said, 60-70% of my stuff these days is doing ships. So, and it's fun because I do five different 30-minute shows, two family-friendly and three adult. And it's really, I mean, for years, for decades, I had a 45-minute act. And now I have 2.5 hours of material. And so now whatever position I'm placed in, whether I got to do a corporate show or a clean show for a maybe senior community or a stand-up comedy in 2 weeks, I'm in Vegas with Brad Garrett. So it just, you know, depending on what situation, I've got 40 minutes for that situation.
That's fantastic. So with that many cruises, how many cruises would you do in a month?
Well, I just did four in a row.
Wow.
Last 2 weeks, I just did four.
You don't find them to get, well, you're working every night. I remember our mutual friend Steve Van Zandt used to tell me that a long time ago, he used to be hired, he would do it just like one show, and then the rest of the week, he'd be on the boat with nothing to do.
And that's exactly why I only work for Carnival.
Ah.
Because the other lines, you'll get on a Monday, and they'll tell you, well, you got a show on Tuesday, and then possibly on Friday night. I can't live like that.
Yeah.
I don't need to be on a cruise. That's not important to me. I've been on 423 of them. I don't need a cruise.
You must weigh 9,000 pounds.
No. And a buddy of mine, Jeff Jenna, asked me, how do you keep – because I dropped 52 pounds since working on cruise ships. And people always ask me, how do you drop weight and keep it off? And I say, easy. The stairs and the salad bar are always empty.
Yeah, that's right. Nobody does either.
I eat nothing, but I became vegetarian about 6 years ago, so that kind of helps. But the salad bar and the stairs are always empty, so I use them both all the time.
And the walking track on the 15th floor or whatever. Right?
Yep, I did that 2 days ago. Sure did.
That's
six
nice.
Miles.
But, I love that.
Yeah, so I don't work the other lines because on Carnival, we're always – we might have one day off throughout each contract, but normally each night you're doing at least one show. I don't need to work on Monday and then have Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday off, and then another goodbye show on Friday.
Right. How many vacations can you take? Right.
Yeah, exactly. I in fact, that would frustrate me more to be out there twiddling my thumbs because I would be – it would be like wasted time that I could be doing something here in L.A. furthering my career here in town.
Sure. Well, John, it's been fantastic talking to you. It really has been. And how do people get your album?
You can get my CD. If you want an autographed copy, a hard copy, you can find me on Facebook or Instagram or Twitter and send me a message. Or send an email to john@johndecrosta.com. My website is currently down because it's being redesigned. But you can email me at john@johndecrosta.com. Or if you don't need an autographed hard copy, you can buy it on iTunes. It's John DeCrosta, Multiple Character Disorder, iTunes $9.99. It's on Walmart.com, Target.com, Best Buy, Amazon. You can buy it almost anywhere you buy CDs these days. And it's like $10.
And it's very, very funny. I listened to the whole thing yesterday.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. And SiriusXM plays me an awful lot. I'm on Channel 97, which is the old blue collar station, and then 99, which is Raw Dog. They play me awful lot on 97 and 99 on SiriusXM.
That's terrific. Well, I'm so glad you're doing well and doing all these varied things. I don't do a lot of video games at my age, but I do look at movies, so I'll be listening for your voice.
Yeah, thanks, man. Always good to talk to you, buddy. I cherish the time we spent together back in those days back at the Comedy Works and stuff. I always listened to you on the radio when I was home, and it really means a lot that we could do this. This is great.
Same here. And every time I hear hoo-hoo-hoo, I will think of you. That's so great. John, thank you so much.
All right, buddy. Thanks so much, Richie. I appreciate it, pal.
Great talking to you. Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.
There he goes. There was John DeCrosta. That was my brush with greatness 35 years ago. Little did I know, I'd be rubbing elbows with the Pillsbury Doughboy. No, he's really doing great, isn't he? And by the way, you're going to have a chance to go see him if you're in the Albany area, because he texted me right after we hung up on each other. He's going to be at Proctor's in Schenectady, New York on New Year's Eve. So just go to proctors.org and see if the tickets are available yet. I don't know if they are, or at least wait for them to be available, and go see John. And if you're really desperate for entertainment, you can go see me. I know this is going to be very dated for people who check in on this podcast later on, but I just want to let you know that this Friday at the Eden Cafe, I'm going to be doing a tribute to song parodies. Parodies that famous people have written, parodies that I've written from WGNA years, some new ones that I'm messing with. You can come up and grab the mic as well and give us some of the funniest songs you remember. It's the Eden Cafe, 269 Osborne Road in Albany. It's actually Loudonville, but it comes up Albany on the GPS for some weird reason. Tickets are only $7.50. You can call and make the reservation at 518-997-3771. I will have that phone number in the show notes if you don't remember it. And you can also go to eventbrite.com, eventbrite, B-R-I-T-E.com, one word, and just type in Richie Phillips and you will find the event and you can order your ticket online there. It's a piano bar atmosphere, which I love. It's a small place. It only fits like 40 people, but it's a great place to do shtick. And I always love playing there and would love to see you. I have a special guest joining me for this one. His name is Drew Jacobs. People from this area have to have seen him someplace doing his novelty songs. It's going to be like, you ever see these dueling piano nights? This is like dueling novelty night. You'll get to hear some of his originals, some of mine, and we can maybe even sing harmony. Who knows? I also have another guest, a lady who's been with me so many times there. She's an incredible animator, artist, singer, plays the guitar, plays the piano. She's really multi-talented and always have a great time with her. Jennifer Goodwin is coming back to sing some of the ones she's written. Friday night, November the 2nd, starts at 7:30 and it ends at 9:30. That's so I don't miss my bedtime because it's usually around 10. Hope to see you all there. In the meantime, if you have any ideas for a podcast, if somebody you'd like to hear on here, all you got to do is send me an email at richie1077@gmail.com. I'll have that in the show notes as well. Tell me who you'd like to have on, and I will try as hard as I can and be a pain in the butt until I
take it to the top. To the top.
Please don't forget to subscribe on iTunes or podbean.com. This way you'll know when I post the next one. And in the words of the late, great Andy Kaufman,
thank you very much.